What's up, everyone? Welcome to Dipped in Tone. I'm Rhett.
I'm Zach.
And it's a duo episode today. Look at us.
Flying duo.
Flying solo.
Flying what? Duo.
You know. Oh, man. What's new?
This is always funny because sometimes we'll layer up the episodes and it's like, wait, what did we talk about? Lately, I've been knee deep in plastic. You know what I'm saying? You heard about this? You heard about this thing called plastic?
The way the environment's going, we're kind of all knee deep in plastic at this
plastic
point.
Plastic, we are one with the plastic.
We are one.
But I made a video about Les Paul plastics.
I watched it. I saw
and
it.
And I don't know.
There you go.
So I actually found a supplier and I've been selling all these plastics. So now I have all these baggies of different baggies of replica parts, and it's really cool and it's really fun and people like it and it's making me happy.
Dude, that video did pretty well. I'll admit, I was shocked a little bit to see that many people cared about Les Paul plastics.
Man, I think you're kind of far removed from that corner of the internet.
Yeah.
So you've not lurked on the Les Paul forum as much as I have?
No.
Maybe?
No. All I remember is when I got my USA standard a few years ago, the first thing was you sent me a whole suite of plastics because it bothered you. Not because I told you that I wanted new plastics or whatever. It's like, no, I can't stand looking at that guitar on your videos. Here, put all this shit on there. And it's like, okay.
Well, now I can do it for your R9 if you want.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
But yeah, I mean, that's been fun. It's always when you're running a business and you're just trying to figure out what's going to hit, because you never know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big fan of just literally throwing everything at the wall, which sometimes means losing a lot of money. But, you know, you got to take all
the
shots.
The plastics I feel like your overhead on the plastics is pretty low compared to pedals development and distribution and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a minimal investment. I don't have to buy that much, but it's also you spend a couple $1,000s on plastic and they just sit there. You're like, well, what do I do with this? I just give it all to Rhett to put in his R9.
Don't want it. Don't want it.
Yeah. No.
Man, I'm actually in the process right now of planning a studio rebuild up here. So, quick update for the four of you watching that care. My big studio build downstairs is starting to pick back up again. The goal is to get it finally knocked out this year. It's taking way too long. But part of that is this room I'm in right now is a bedroom. And so the whole thing was when we bought this house and we moved in a few years ago, I threw this room together in 3 days because I had to get production rolling and everything. And there's just been some issues with how I put this room together that keep sort of compounding. And I've redone the room a few different times. Once a year, I'll kind of go through. But dude, my cable management is a nightmare. It's horrible. My patch bay is all screwed up. So I think I'm going to just gut this room completely, take everything out and start over. I think I want to do a new desk setup. But the thing is, I'm trying to do it right this time because when the studio is done downstairs, this room will remain an editing suite, sort of, mixing room kind of thing. So I can be working downstairs and we can have somebody up here editing and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've been spending all morning on Sweetwater looking at desks and looking at patch bays and all kinds of stuff, trying to plan it all out. So
yeah,
that's what's been going on.
Man, the thought of doing that sort of thing, because we're in the process of revamping our shop. And, what a nightmare to have to, because you having to take all those amps off the shelf and then take it all out, in the hallway, we would have to take every pedal off the shelf, move all the shelves, get new shelves that get taller. It's like,
oh, dude, the amps are nothing. The real beast is the cabling. You can't see the back end of my patch bays down here, but it's terrifying. It looks like something from the Matrix. When they're in that underground world and there's those machines with all the tentacles and stuff. That's what the back of my patch bay looks like right now.
Nice.
It's a nightmare. And it works. It passes signal, but it's it's not real great. So continuing the console hunt as well. So
fun.
We'll see. We'll see if that happens or not.
Very exciting.
So that's what's been going on. Are we doing a sponsor?
We'll insert sponsor thing here.
Hey, just want to break in here real quick and tell you about our Patreon. It's a great way to support the show. If you like what we're doing over here, link is in the description. We do things like patron-only Q&A episodes and a few other things. You can learn about the tiers and everything that's involved with the Patreon linked in the description box down below.
That's right. And thanks again to Chase Bliss for sponsoring this episode. Go to chasebliss.com, enter the coupon code DIPPED, and you get 10% off your order. You can explore all the varietals of stuff that Chase Bliss is creating, and sign up for their newsletter, see what else they got coming out, because who knows? There could be something that's new
for
and
real.
Exciting.
I bought this because I got notified by their newsletter, because when they drop stuff, it goes super fast, and this was a limited run. A collaboration they did with ZVEX. This is the Bliss Factory Fuzz. They only made a handful of these, like I think 400 or something, or the first batch was 400. Anyways, I was able to get my hands on it because I was a member of their mailing list, and I saw it and jumped on and immediately bought it. So thanks again, Chase Bliss, for sponsoring the episode.
Do that. Dipped, chasebliss.com. Thank you so much, Chase Bliss. Back to it.
Okay, so it's time. Because when we have guests on, we rarely get to talk about like current event gear stuff, which is really what we built this podcast on four years ago now, whatever it's been. So we're going to do that today. We're going to dive in the weeds. We're going to look at some of the new gear that's coming out. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about how exciting it all is and how kind of riveting the world of guitar gear is right now.
I can sense your enthusiasm pouring out of the camera. I think on our side of the screen, we're really excited about all this stuff, because it kind of is like this sort of barometer of what is happening. So for guys like me who are in that side of the industry, we get really, maybe not excited might not be the right word, but interested, because it's always curious what people are doing and what hits or flops. So I'm into it, but I feel like you're on a bit of a guitar burnout journey.
It's not necessarily guitar burnout. It's just that I'm interested in other, like the stuff that gets me excited right now is summing mixers. Like we could talk about the Neve 8816 if we want. That would get me really fired up and ready to go.
Man.
No, it's like I'm a guitar player. I love guitar stuff, but I kind of have what I want.
Sure. Like,
Jason says somebody stop Rhett from talking about mixers. I'm just saying that the Neve 8816 is arguably one of the best summing mixers. I don't know. I'm not burned out, but I don't know. There's other parts of the music industry space right now that's getting me fired up, like the samplers and summing mixers.
Right. I get it. You know, hey, it's fine. Why don't we jump in with one of the most current releases that just came out that you just kind of learned about, the new Pod Express, which is kind of a return to form for, it's not the bean. We're not getting the bean back. But it from what I can tell, it looks plastic.
It does look plastic
in the photos, which is like, that's an interesting choice.
It is interesting. I kind of wish, okay, this would be a power move, Line 6 power move, if they reissued the kidney bean, but with like the modern Helix ecosystem inside, that would actually be pretty rad.
Well, how this thing works, it's kind of like, you know, it's taken all the HX stomp and, well, HX, whatever, that's like the whole overarching topology, and putting it in, you know, a really small modeling pedal. And it's cool. Like it has like cab emulation. I don't know if you can upload IRs to it. I doubt that.
It's only $179. So, you know.
Yeah. But it has, you know, all the effects, drives, modulation, delay, reverb. You have all amp control. You can change the cabs as presets. It seems a bit of like a, you've really got to learn, because you have to hold foot switches to turn stuff, to do stuff. You know, it's like a whole thing. But it's kind of cool, because I think the thing that we're starting to see more of is the need for these sort of at-home solutions. I mean, we talked about that. But I like that it's got a headphone. Oh, look, Jason's showing it to us right here on the screen. You can't see it, but we can see it.
We can see it. There it is.
but it has a headphone solution, which is cool. Cause I think that's one thing that some of the pedal amp in a box things are lacking.
Well, I like the price point of this. Yeah. I think that's the best thing it's got going for it. You know, it's under $200. It'll be a decent sounding, you know, direct solution. Can you bypass the amp modeling and just use it as a effects processor?
I don't think so. It does have like a battery door in the back, like a Game Boy, and you can put AA batteries in it.
Oh, hell yeah.
Which is neat. But yeah.
Yeah, Bruno in the chat saying for the price, it seems like a good backup to have in your gig bag. And that's kind of what I see this thing as. It's not going to be someone's primary rig, so to speak, unless it's, you know, a beginner player, somebody getting used to it kind of thing. And
it's got expression and stuff. It's cool.
Yeah, it's got some interesting IO on the back of it. I mean, it's a cool little piece. I think what'll be nice is for someone who's getting into guitar and learning about the different effects and different sounds and everything, and maybe you live in an apartment, you don't have a space to turn up a small like modeling amp or whatever, and you want to plug headphones into it. I mean, look at the effects layout on the thing. It's pretty comprehensive. You've got on the distortion side, boost, overdrive, distortion, and fuzz. Modulation has chorus, flanger, phaser, trim. Delay has analog, digital, tape, and ping pong. Mm-hmm. And then spring, hall, plate, and space reverb. I mean, that's pretty comprehensive.
I think about, because like, I don't even think about the people who are playing in an apartment. I think about the teenager who just got a guitar. I remember how annoying I was learning, like, for whom the bell tolls and stuff through my PV backstage amp, just going, just driving the entire house mad. If I had had something like this, I would have been in heaven, and my parents would have been so glad that I could have had something like that. So I think it's a really cool thing. I'm excited that, because I really like all the HX stuff. I mean, it's not.
I do too.
You know, for what it is, I think it's fantastic.
I really love the effects. And again, like that to me is the biggest value sort of part of this is for $180, you're getting a pretty cool multi-effect pedal. Looking at some of the IO here, it's stereo out if you want to get into that. I mean, there's a lot you could do with this. If you're building a little basic studio setup at home, you could, you know, plug this into a small interface and have some effects processing. You could, they have a bass version as well for bass players. I mean, yeah, dude. And it's like one of those things. It's $180. Is it going to blow your mind? Probably not. But for under $200, not bad.
Yeah, I think it's neat. Next thing, this year is the 70th. anniversary of the Fender Stratocaster. So we're seeing an there's like, I feel like every 10 years we get another 1954 Strat.
Yep.
But it's cool that this instrument, which is still arguably probably the most synonymous with electric guitar. Like when you think about electric guitar, I'd say
when most people think about an electric guitar, they're probably picturing a Stratocaster, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, if you ask someone to draw an electric guitar, they would probably try to draw a Strat.
Right.
So yeah,
it looks cool, man. I mean, I watched Matthew Scott's video on it yesterday, and you know, he knows his stuff, especially with old Strats. And I thought it was a great video. You should check it out if you haven't watched it. He's an amazing player, and I think he did a good job of kind of walking through the good stuff and the bad stuff. But it looks like they did a pretty decent job of
There's a few like kind of tribute models, right?
Yeah. Let me see here.
I watched RJ's demo of it, and it looks great. You know, I think it's cool that, you know, they're getting the Bakelite pickup covers and all that stuff. But
already back ordered on Sweetwater there. So, and they said they were doing a limited number of these, right?
I think so. But there's going to be like, you know, player versions. So you can get, if you want that sort of old school look, you can get it at every price point. But it's just neat to see. I mean, like, I don't know. It's hard for me to get too excited about another version of a Stratocaster. but yeah, it's still cool.
It is cool. I mean, I like that they're offering this for someone that wants as close to a 54 Strat as you could get from Fender, that without going custom shop. I mean, it fills an interesting space in their lineup. You know, it's $2,600. Mm-hmm. You know, to get a custom shop equivalent of that, you'd probably be pushing $6,000, maybe $5,000 to $6,000.
I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm not as familiar with the Fender custom shop lineup as I used to be. Cause I feel like the last big anniversary, they made a bigger splash about making a sort of custom replica of that sort of thing. But, yeah, I think the one thing that's kind of missing, if I had to gripe at all, and I don't mean to, but I can't help it. a lot of early Strats had really narrow nuts because they, you know,
right.
You hear people talk about an A neck or a B neck, and that is more with the width of the neck itself. Because if you've ever played like a 54 A neck, it almost feels like a student guitar. It's got a very narrow feeling nut and neck, and they're weird. And the transition from the neck onto the back of the headstock on 54 is very specific. And I'd have to look at photos of some vintage ones to remember exactly. Fender nuts out there would know better than me, but it's kind of like an awkward thing. They hadn't figured it out quite right. yet, which is right. weird because they've been making the Tele for, you know, a couple of years.
Well, and also the body contours were all kind of different in those early years. So I'm wondering which shape they went for, because you play some old Strats and the edges are actually kind of hard. Like, they're not as rounded over. They're almost more like hard corners, and the belly cut or the body contours are not cut the same way. And then you play some later ones and they're really soft and sort of pillowy feeling. So I haven't played one of these, so I don't know which one they went after.
Right. I think some of that, and this is something that is true on like a Gibson pickup cover. You know, everyone talks about like a vintage correct pickup cover. But if you look at vintage PAFs, the shape of the pickup cover changed over time. And that was because all the Yeah,
for a set of PAFs. So you're an admitted PAF nerd, I would say. What do you think about these things?
Well, admittedly, I haven't played them. So I know someone that bought a set. I haven't got feedback on what they sounded like. But I think the case is cool.
Yeah, the little tiny...
the mini lift-in case that you yeah. can take the insert out. You can put stuff in there when you're not using it, you know, all sorts of stuff. I mean,
are people actually going to do that, though?
I mean, I would.
Okay, so let's look on Reverb here, because I imagine... So they're listed on Gibson's site for $9.99.
Yeah.
Let's see, where are they at here with... I'm sure there's some scalpers. It's a $59
there has to coin. Be. It's an interesting thing because when you look at, because they're talking about it's the most accurate replica, right?
Right.
And we both know John from Throwback.
Right.
Seymour Duncan has the Lasona 102B that Gibson made a lot of PAFs on. And John has pretty much all the rest of the winders that Gibson used. So to me, that is the biggest factor of what like contributes to part of the authenticity of something.
Right.
It's not just like on paper, you know, this is the correct bobbin with all the dimensions right and the correct wire and magnets, et cetera. Like, those are the ingredients, but two chefs can make wildly different dishes with the same ingredients.
Nice. I just dropped a link in the chat. Here's a Reverb listing. Somebody's asking $2,500 for their Collector's Edition 1 PAF set. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I've played some throwbacks before in your guitars. I think they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I think PAFs are so easy to come by, especially in the boutique pickup market. I personally, I'm not dropping $1,000. Or now in this case, so this guy's asking $2,500. The other ones that are for sale, there is five listed on Reverb right now, and they range from $1,470 up to $2,500. I'm
right there with you. I feel like there needs to be a little bit more detail. It was an odd release because I feel like they didn't actually make a web page for it until recently. Right. And to kind of come out of the gate with a product like that, with a price like that, I feel like you have to have a little more pomp and circumstance to kind of warrant the price tag. I mean, admittedly, throwbacks now are $600-$700, but you can look at every single thing and know, like, Gibson has proprietary parts, sure, but throwback, literally everything is made in the States, and he'll tell you exactly where he gets it. So, right. I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of Custom Buckers. I've never been a fan of them since they switched to different magnet types. They just don't feel right to me.
Right.
But I don't know. Color me curious. I feel like I feel like what they did with the Peter Green guitar, the really high end one, I played one. That's one of the best sounding guitars I've ever played.
Right.
And I don't know. I know they can make pickups. It's a weird thing. It's really weird.
I mean, when they get it right, they get it right. Like, there's no question about that with Gibson. Like, when their custom shop nails it, it's damn good.
Yeah.
With me, you know, if I'm spending money on PAFs or PAF clones, I think I'm going with throwback just because, like, yes, they are expensive, but I have worked with John on some videos in the past. I know him. I know the attention to detail, the absurd attention to detail that he puts into that kind of thing. And again, the fact that he's got the original machines, to me, that's more appealing than the custom case and all the paperwork and the collectability of the Gibson ones, because it's like, well, this was actually made on the machine that the real ones were made on.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's half the price some of these Reverb prices, less than half the price, you know?
Right. Well, we don't want to dump on Gibson too hard because they have released something that was really awesome. So I have one of these here and you have another one, the Gibson Falcon amps.
Yes.
Really, really great. Yeah. I've got the 20.
I've got the 5 and I just realized it's still plugged into the wall.
That's okay. So. It looks just like this, only smaller.
Yeah, it's that but smaller, and it's, you know, imagine it here.
Yeah.
Man, I really like mine. I really like the Falcon 5. Technically, it's a 7-watt amp. I made a video with it a few weeks ago talking about how to make small amps sound big mm-hmm. with some mic recording techniques and things like that. And it has stayed up here in the room with me while I've been, you know, working. And I personally, I much prefer playing my guitar through an amp in the room rather than hearing it through monitors or headphones. Now, obviously plugins and things like that have their place. They're very useful. And I do play plugins and I do play my modelers. But like when I got this and unboxed it, I found myself actually playing a lot more because I could just set it on the 1 watt and play. And it sounded good. It sounded like a real amp in the room. And yeah, I dug it. But I've not played the bigger one.
Yeah. I played the 5 at a local guitar store, and I really liked it. And I tried the 20 and liked it, but I couldn't crank it. And so Gibson Garage very kindly lent me this one. And it's awesome. I mean, I do have a couple like gripes about like the tremolo speed and stuff. I feel like it should go a little faster.
Right.
It goes plenty slow, which is cool. I think the reverb sounds really good on
it. I like the reverb on the 5 too. My only gripe with it is, and I didn't realize this until I started getting comments on it on my video, but on the 5, I don't know if the 20 is this way, but on the 5, the preamp tubes are mounted directly to the circuit board.
Well, the sockets are on the board and then the tubes come out they're pointed like this way. I've heard about that as well. And the one thing that I kind of want to do is I kind of want to plug it up and leave it on and see how hot it gets, because there is ventilation on the top. This one has a fan for the power tubes, the typical Mesa thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It feels like it's far enough away to where it wouldn't cause any problems, but because the heat's rising. I feel like a lot of times when people moan about PCB mounted tube sockets, the tubes are mounted down, and so that heat is coming up, and that's what's causing an issue with your solder joints or whatever is around it. So it feels like the tube and all the things that actually is generating heat is far enough away from the PCB to not damage anything.
Yeah.
It's just something to be aware of. But at the end of the day, it's a pretty affordable American-made product.
Yeah.
That I don't think it's worth like getting too pissed off about, personally.
Well, it's the internet. People are going to get pissed off. So, I mean, I had my Falcon 5 on for a number of hours each day when I was filming with it. And it would get warm up top, but not that bad compared to like my Tweed Deluxe, for example. Like the top panel of a Tweed Deluxe can get hot enough where you can't touch the damn thing.
Oh yeah.
And now those tubes are chassis mounted instead of PCB mounted. My only concern with the sockets being on the circuit board is the long-term reliability, especially if you're gigging with this amp and you are, you know, in and out of trailers, in and out of gigs and venues all the time. But, you know, Mesa builds good stuff. So
I don't know. I'm curious about it. I think it's going to be fine for the most part. I had a Friedman Dirty Shirley, like the big one, and that amp chassis, I mean, the tubes are like way down here and you'd touch the input and you could cook an egg on the faceplate of that thing. It was so hot and the tubes were so far away. And I emailed him and Dave answered and he was like, yeah, it just gets hot. Like, okay.
Yeah, it just does that.
But there is one thing that's funny, and I don't know if the 5 does this. When you dime the input gain on the 20, which is not, it's more like, this is like a Princeton. It's more like 12 or some wattage. So all misnomers. This is an homage to the classic thing. It almost turns into like a fuzz. Does the 5 do that?
It gets pretty hairy. I wouldn't necessarily call it fuzz territory per se, but it's, if you're on the top input, the higher input, and you push that volume, it gets pretty saturated.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a cool sound. It definitely sounds old, which I think is cool. But anyway,
I'm just really glad that they made an amp that looks right and that sounds right. You know,
absolutely.
We've been talking about this for years, you know, knowing that Gibson had bought Mesa and was going to be making amps again. I think they're on the right track with this line.
Yeah, so. I think if this is any indication of what they're trying to do, it's a great step. Yeah. In the right direction. So the little brother to Gibson, Epiphone, just released a couple things. They released the Firebird 1 and the 5.
Right.
And these, as opposed to being inspired by like Gibson standard stuff, these are inspired by more of the custom. So that's why you're getting some of the more interesting colors and not the more standard ebony, sunburst, etc. I think these things are great. And in addition to that, they just released the Dave Grohl Trini Lopez 335 model, whatever. Let me find the official title of this thing.
It's probably not 335, whatever, Trini Lopez,
well, I know, Dave Grohl
model. So I love this. I'm looking at the Firebird 5 right now, 63 Firebird 5 from Epiphone, $1,699.
It's a hefty price.
It's a hefty price, but the Firebird's one of those guitars that, like, it's how this is probably not going to be someone's like first guitar. Do you know what I mean? Like, probably you probably not. Already have a few bases covered, and like most people don't go for a Firebird 5 as the end all be all. Now, I have a Firebird, I have a custom shop Firebird, and I love it. But like, where else are you going to get a Firebird other than custom shop? But does USA even make a Firebird 5? I don't think they do.
I'd have to look and see. I'm not entirely sure. The Dave Grohl is the DG335.
Oh, there you go.
But yeah, I think it's an interesting choice. I think that it's cool that regardless of the price, it's a lot more affordable than what most Firebirds were going to be for the average person. If you're buying a new guitar, I think that's been the argument that I've seen the most. Like I did the I got a Kirk Hammett Flying V, and people in the comments section, when I made a little video about it, were moaning about the price compared to a used Gibson. It's like, you can't, that's apples and oranges.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Yeah. The only other Firebird 5 I'm seeing is a custom shop for $6,500.
Right.
So, I mean, if you want a Firebird, the new Epiphone stuff that they've been building has been great. All the Epiphone stuff that I've played over the last couple of years, like your Flying V, that blue Les Paul we shot out against the Burst last year, like it's good stuff, man.
They're great. I really, really like them. You can't really, like, regardless of the price, you can't really knock it or get too mad about them, because they're just great guitars. I feel like once people experience it, then you just kind of like get over yourself.
Yeah.
But I think this Dave Grohl, the DG335, I think this is going to be the best-selling Epiphone they've done in probably the last, 10 years maybe. I don't know. It's going to sell like crazy.
Yeah. Let me see. Let me pull it up here. Epiphone, Dave Grohl, 33. Yeah, man. Well, he's done so much for that model. I mean, he's really been kind of single-handedly keeping the Trini Lopez sort of in the public eye for so long. This makes sense. And I think they did a good job of sort of, obviously to get the price down, they're going to have to cut some corners compared to a Trini. And I think they made the right choices here, where all of the stuff that matters is still intact, you know, but they it's like a little bit lower resolution, less detail on the headstock, for example. It's not a true like Firebird headstock. It's Firebird-esque, and it doesn't have the Firebird tuners. They're, you know, typical Grovers.
I think his model had the same like mini Rotomatics.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not having like the full tailpiece as well. It's a great looking guitar.
Yeah. I think, it's one of those guitars you'll have to see in person. I think sometimes like the finishes on import guitars, when you see them in photographs, they look a little plasticky. I mean, like, you know, it's a poly.
Yeah.
But I think that's something that once you get it in your hands, it'll probably that sort of, it won't have that sort of effect on you once you actually see it. I saw one of the Epiphone Greenies with the Gibson headstock, and it looked awesome. Like, the top was nice. You know, I don't know. Like, I just feel like Epiphone is really, I don't, there was this moment when they released the Epiphone Elitist guitars years ago, Elite and Elitist.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they discontinued them because they were just so good. And I feel like Epiphone is kind of encroaching on that territory where it's getting harder to make a decision. Like, do you get a standard Gibson or do you just get a nice Epiphone and just,
well, I mean, look at that. That's what Squire's been doing for a long time. You know, when I do these shootouts, the difference is like Fender's lineup. There's more tiers in the lineup. Like, if you look at a Strat, for example, there's several different iterations of a Strat for every different price point. Whereas Gibson, with the Les Paul, there's been Epiphone, and then Studio, then Standard.
If you're just looking at like a carve top, you get the Studio, Standard,
Custom and Shop.
I mean,
but, like, with my experience with the Squire stuff, I've got these Jazzmasters right now. And dude, the Squire classic vibe that I have, it's like $549, and it's really great. I always think, you know, with Fender, the Player series, I never like the Fender Player series because I always think the Squire stuff is much better for less money. The only reason someone I think would buy a Fender Player series over the Squire is that it has to say Fender on the headstock. And if you can get over that, the Squire oftentimes is a better guitar for less money. And I think Epiphone, it's not exactly the same, but I think they're getting to that point where a lot of the Squire affinity stuff has been, some of the classic vibe stuff has been, where it's so good. If you don't care that it says Epiphone on the headstock and it's an import guitar, like, it might be a better choice than, you know, a Gibson.
Right. And that's, I mean, it's a shame to say, and it's not just, you know, I think all the Gibson Standard stuff has been really good. It's not to say that they're bad guitars. It's just like when I was hunting for the 335, I really boiled it down to the custom shop that I got and then an Epiphone. Like all the standard Gibsons, I just like, I couldn't bond with, but I really liked the Epiphones and I really liked the custom shops. And it was a weird thing. I never had had that sort of the disparity in price and the pull, like, man, you know, I could get this Epiphone and I'll save literally like $3,500 or more. You know, it's a weird place to be in, but at the end of the day, it's just giving people who want to get into it just the best guitar that you can start with. You know, like I couldn't imagine starting with even just the Epiphone Special that I have, the Special Les Paul. Like if that was my first guitar, I would have played it forever. You know, I'd still be playing it.
Yeah. Nice. All right. What else? What else we got here?
Well, let's talk about Ed Sheeran released a looper.
I saw that.
And it's really neat. So there's like two versions. There's a smaller one, and then there's a larger one with a screen. And the larger one has the screen where you can basically mix and edit these recordings with all the controls and stuff on the fly. You can create more layers. You can see it all. It's a really – I mean, if that is your bag and you're wanting to loop – professionally, because I mean, this is a professional looper tool. This is not like a bedroom stuff, unless you're, you know, that's just your thing. I think it's got to be the best option that you could possibly get.
Man, yeah, it looks. I'm looking at the Looper X here, the big boy.
Yes,
it's interesting, man. It's kind of Line 6-ish in its layout. You know,
the foot switches look just like the Tone Lock pedals.
Yeah.
The ones that you put in the little
Well, do we know who's building these?
So I believe it's the Headrush. So I guess that's a Kai, right? Yeah. The DSP is powered by Headrush, so.
Nice. I mean, yeah, it's cool. And I think, you know, it makes sense for him. He's got to be making so much money off this stuff, dude. My God. He's got his own line of guitars that Loudon's doing, now the Loopers. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant move for an artist to start putting this stuff out rather than just doing endorsement deals with companies. It's like, no, I'll just make my own stuff. And I imagine he's selling it direct, you know?
Well, it's on SheeranGuitars.com, like on his website. I mean, they're 1,200 pounds. I switched it to dollars and it didn't convert. So, I mean, I guess that's what? It's probably like 1,800 bucks or something.
Yeah, I guess you got to go to the airport into one of those big currency exchange places and get them to swap it out and then go buy the thing.
Oh, it's $12.99 in Sweetwater. So, I mean, wow, you know, that's interesting. I feel like it's just a cool unit if you want to dive into that world.
Well, yeah, and I think it makes sense for his fan base too, because it's such a big part of what he does, you know. Mm-hmm. A buddy of mine is playing guitar for him right now, a Atlanta guy who's on tour with him in his band, and it's interesting to see how they have it set up, his touring setup, where it's like he's basically in the middle of a stadium on the stage with his looping setup and everything, but then he's got a band sort of off to the side, almost out of sight, out of mind. So, I mean, this isn't really my thing. I've never really been a looper person. The only time I ever messed with one is just to, you know, practice with as a way to, you know, put down a chord progression or some kind of just one chord and practice modes or whatever on top of it. But again, if you're a singer-songwriter and you're into this kind of thing, I think he's so integrated into the looping art form that to be able to put out like a bespoke looper like this is really cool. Because I mean, again, I'm not super familiar with this part of the market, but outside of what is it? The boss,
RC.
What is the big boss looper?
Well, there's like the loop station.
But there's the big loop station, right?
I mean, there's, you know, a variety of them. I remember the big boomerang looper and stuff. And he does there. Well, I say he, I mean, he has in this lineup, there's the Looper Plus, which is like 300 pounds. So it's probably around similar dollars. And it looks more kind of like the traditional Boss sort of looper with two foot switches, record play, stop or pause, and just some really nice IO and a screen. So I don't know. I really like looping for practicing. When I sat in with Corey Congelio and had to learn like I played a couple of ZZ Top songs and I'd never learned the rhythm parts. I'd always played in a trio. Mm-hmm. And so I just played the solos and the bass player filled in the back. And so I actually had to learn all the stuff. And so I was using the loopers on my HX Stomp to just practice. And I'd forgotten how much I enjoy that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool. If you're into that kind of thing, like this might be worth looking at. And the smaller one, see, that's the, so the Looper X, 1200 British pounds, the Looper Plus, 299, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool little setup here.
Yeah. So one thing that I saw recently that was very interesting is, and maybe we can kind of wrap up the main part of the show with this, the Marshall Group that bought Marshall recently did an article with Billboard and said that the amplifier portion of their sales in the past year only made up 5% of their total sales. Everything else was Bluetooth speakers and headphones. And they said, in addition to all that, that they're moving to a focus on digital amplification. And I don't know what that means for all the tube stuff that they have made, are making, but it looks like they're kind of veering away from that. Who's to say, but
I really hope not. I mean, it just makes me sad.
It is a bummer, but like who in this day and age are kind of the champions of the Marshall guitar sound?
Yeah, I mean, they don't really have a lot of I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like, who are the young, hip players out there now that have a following, that have influence, that are really repping the Marshall brand? And I'm sure there are some. They're just not really coming to mind.
Or maybe not even, like, the brand, but just that sort of sound. Because
I would say the sound is a little bit more ubiquitous because there's so many – it's like one of the primary food groups of guitar sound, you know, there's like right. The Fender Vox Marshall thing. Right. So I would say there's a lot more people going for that sound. The difference is now there's so many other ways to get that sound mm-hmm. than having to, you know, go down to your local guitar shop and buy a, you know, a JCM 800 or whatever. Right. So I see what they're doing. They're using their name and their brand to appeal to the to the general public, right? Because again, mm-hmm. like a Stratocaster, like we talked about, if you had someone, you know, off the street and say, "Hey, what does a guitar amp look like?" There's a good chance they might be thinking of some kind of Marshall stack or half stack because yeah. it's just so ubiquitous with the image of rock and roll, right? Mm-hmm. And so I understand that they're using that image to push sales. I mean, I've seen those Marshall Bluetooth speakers around, and they're always in some kind of like it's like, do you have those bougie hip pop-up barber shops around that are like, you know, they always have some like weird name like Leather and Bourbon or something like that, and it's a place where you go get your hair cut. It's always in those kind of places where I mm-hmm. see these Marshall speakers, and it's because it fits this aesthetic of like renegade rock and roll. Like, oh yeah, we've got a guitar amp in the corner. It's not a guitar amp; it's a Bluetooth speaker, and you're listening to Rihanna on it. But like, so I get it.
Sound good, the little Bluetooth speakers.
Yeah, but who cares? I mean, there's a million Bluetooth speakers that sound good.
Like, well, no, for sure. But I think it's interesting to see that. I mean, I think this is what everyone was kind of worried about when Marshall got bought, that, oh, this, they're just going to say to the amps and just focus on this stuff, which hopefully that won't be the case. I mean, I think the studio JTM was awesome. It sounded really good. I played some and they sounded great.
Yeah. The stuff they're making is great. Like the 20 watt studio series stuff, this sounds amazing, you know, and they're luckily, I think they're still doing the 59 hand wired. Like you can still get 100 watt plexi.
Right.
From them, which is great. I'm worried. I'm really worried that you won't be able to get a Marshall from Marshall mm-hmm. in the traditional sense. Like, you won't be able to get a JCM 800. You won't be able to get a 59 hand wired or an 87X. You won't be able to get, you know, they might keep the Studio Series alive, but they're going to lean really into the digital stuff. And again, it's like the market's going to dictate what they do, right? They're a company. They got to make money. And now they've been bought out by whatever their, what's the name of that big?
I don't, it's conglomerate. I just saw the Marshall Group or something like that. I think the thing that has kind of shot them in the foot, ever since the Valve State stuff, you remember those?
The MG stuff.
Was the MG was solid state, and then they did Valve State, which had like a little window with a 12AX7.
Yeah,
in the front.
I remember that.
Those like sold pretty well for them, but ever since then, the code. Bad. It was a bad modeling amp. The Origin stuff is okay at best. I don't feel like they've been able to capture that sort of interest from new players or players that might never been able to afford them previously.
Did it start even as far back as like the Vintage Modern? Remember that amp?
Yeah. I mean, probably. I mean, that was still kind of in the era of when like bands played big amps on stage. I don't think those amps. I think those amps actually sounded good, but they didn't hit very well.
Man, yeah, I'm just worried.
Yeah, it's a sad thing. It's a curious thing. I think we're gonna see more and more stuff like this kind of change. I hope it never goes away. I mean, I don't ever want. I mean, I got a half stack in my room. I don't want any of this stuff to go away.
Oh yeah, but, I've got a 59 hand wired. Downstairs, 100-watt plexi downstairs.
But at the same time, it's like gigging musicians probably aren't using this stuff. It's only the nerds like us who are buying these things.
Yeah, it is. I think the writing's on the wall for that type of thing. For brands like that who are making stuff. I mean, we are a very, 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 very niche market of people that. And you know, the case could be made, like we're sitting here complaining and hoping that they don't stop making this stuff, but it's like we're not necessarily buying it either. Like if I'm gonna go spend $3,000 or $4,000 on an amp, am I gonna go buy a Marshall? I don't know. Versus some of the other stuff that's out there. So I understand where they're coming from. It just makes me sad.
and maybe we can end on this and you can give me your thoughts, because this was like some shop talk before I hopped on. I think it's, I honestly feel like the direction this should go is only do really nice high-end stuff. And I think they should be made, you know, in the UK, legit, how they should be made, and just lean into that and do that as well as possible. Just stick with the classic heads, really nice cabs, 18-watt combo, Bluesbreaker combo, and just make that.
And then yes, and... because they're going to need some kind of digital facing side. Like it's going to have to happen for them to stay relevant and everything. So yes, the amps you should make should be like that. I mean, look at what Hiwatt has done. I think Hiwatt's a good example of that. Like the Hiwatt stuff that's made now, they're made in Canada, but still it's like really, really great, super well made, true to the original. But also you're going to need some kind of digital facing side. And so I say for them, lean into the plug-in market. Really, really lean into like making the best Marshall plugins. Go into your vault and make profiles and plugins of the most famous amps that you have. Put them out there for sale. Because the beautiful thing about that stuff is there's no overhead. Once the thing's done and you're just selling code, NFRs basically, selling downloads. And then, you know, partnering, what would be really cool would be to see, you know, big legacy brands like this partner with some of the best modeling brands in the game, you know, Quad Cortex, Line 6, Kemper even, to maybe even license some of this stuff where it's like, hey, here's the official Marshall Quad Cortex pack, you know, that was captured at Marshall Studio. This is Jimmy Page's plexi that you could put in, like that type of thing I think is really cool. And I understand that they'll continue to do the Bluetooth speaker thing and all that stuff. It just, every time I see one of those Marshall Bluetooth speakers, know. It pisses me off.
I know what someone's getting for Christmas.
Just something so wrong about seeing a Marshall knob on a Bluetooth speaker. Like, you know what I mean? Like, because they have the actual amp knobs on there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that just, I don't know.
Oh, man.
Really. And to, just one last aside for this. I think in the coming years, unfortunately, we're going to start to see more of this stuff. Like Moog just sold to In Music last year. And I am hopeful that In Music does the right thing with that brand, but I'm not optimistic. I think because Moog was employee owned, they were based in Asheville, North Carolina. Everything that you bought from Moog was built in Asheville, North Carolina. And now they're moving all their production over to China and it's not employee owned anymore. And when you look at, you know, arguably Moog is as important of a legacy brand as Fender or Marshall. When you look at what they did for music as in pop culture in general. So I think we're going to start to see this a lot more in the coming years where these big investment brands come and buy up these legacy MI brands and does who know what with them.
You know, all that says to me is we need to get some money so we can buy some of these brands.
Hell yeah.
Well, do you have a shill, Mr. Retshill?
Yes, but you should go first.
Okay. I want to get mine.
Okay. Totally forgot that we were doing this.
So mine is a 3-in-1 and you're going to love it. So in an effort to expand my ever growing collection, I have added 3 Tube Screamers.
Oh my God, dude. Why?
To the pop. Because I got to catch them all, dude.
Why?
Actually, there's 4, but this one, I got this one, but it doesn't work. I got to return it.
I'm shocked. The plastic Tube Screamer doesn't work?
No.
Oh, wow.
It bypasses, doesn't work. I got the TS7. This was a gift from my friend Brian at Mass Street Music. Thank you, Brian. You're the best. And then I got the new Tube Screamer. Remember these?
No.
It has a little Korg new tube in it that That's lights up.
So rad.
This one sounds, you'd actually like this one. This one sounds different. It sounds really good. And it's got a clean mix. And then Rhett, I got the 45th anniversary blue one. Oh, isn't it pretty? Look at this bat. Look at this box.
I don't understand.
What?
Explain this to me. Make me understand why you keep buying Tube Screamers.
Because I started buying them and I thought, you know what? I might as well see this through to the end. So,
but you could just stop. You could just stop it however many you, last time I was there, you had what, 6?
I think I have 15 now. But I could stop, but I don't know. But why?
Why? I just don't get it, man. I don't.
It's fine. I collect. This is like the
you
one.
You are
thing
a collector.
I collect this and then Ghostbuster stuff. So like that's
it's true. I don't have the collector gene. I just don't have it. It's not in me. I don't feel the need to get all the every iteration of. It's like Josh Scott and his DoD 250s. It's like
Josh gets me. He'd understand.
Yeah. You two can just nerd out all day on that and talk about how many different Tube Screamers you can get. That's great. I'm happy for you. I don't understand it. It's like one of my best friends, Noah, is really into bird watching. I don't understand it. I don't get it. It's not my thing, but he loves it. So more power to you. Whatever blows your skirt up, keep buying That's Tube right. Screamers.
Yay.
I can't remember if I've shilled this before. I don't think I have. So stand with me, but are you hip to these DJI, wireless lav mics?
Oh, I've seen them. Is this the new one that records on the thing itself?
This is, I got this last year. I bought these last year. These are amazing. So DJI, the drone company, I've hit my mic like 4 times this episode. I'm so sorry. They are expanding into their content creator stuff. If you do any kind of content creation online, even just Instagram or TikTok or whatever, YouTube or whatever, like, and you are kind of building out an audio recording setup, these things are rad. So what it is a case that charges them, and you get these two little wireless lavalier microphones that have magnets on the back of them. So you can, what I do is I stick it inside my shirt right here, which is a pro tip from my good friend Philip Conrad, who is a boom operator for big film and TV shows here in Atlanta. So when you put a lav mic on, they'll put it here like in your sternum. Mm-hmm. So it's not rubbing against the shirt. And if you have a black shirt on, you can't see the magnet, it just disappears. And then it wirelessly transmits to this little receiver right here. And you can record either directly on the receiver, or you can attach this into the microphone input of your camera and then just have your wireless lav audio baked right in. It also comes with, you can attach it to your phone. There's some like little adapter mm-hmm. dongles in here. So yeah, this is not a shill. I bought these, but this is, I absolutely love them.
Yeah. Robert Baker came by and we did a thing and he had, I swear it was that, but it had a memory on the mic.
Yeah. You can record, like you can start and stop the recording, but I don't know if, cause I think there is a new version of these that
might be it.
Yeah.
Cause it would record, it had like a flash memory built into the microphone itself. So you had each thing independent, which is like amazing. My favorite, because I have the Rode Go 2, which is okay. But the fact that the case charges that like AirPods is, that's the greatest part.
Man, DJI is killing it with their stuff. I've used a couple of their cameras, like their action cameras and stuff, and these things. I have one of their drones. It's sick. So, yeah, there you go.
Sweet. Well,
awesome.
Yet again, thanks to everyone over on Patreon for supporting the show. If you want to learn about supporting Dipped in Tone, go to patreon.com/dippedintone or click the link in the description below and learn all about the tiers.
Yeah, please sign up because Zach's got to keep buying Tube Screamers. For some reason. Subscribe if you haven't done so here on mm-hmm. YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, click that subscribe button. It helps us out. When you do so, leave a comment. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And we'll see you guys on the next one.